Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a very puzzling incident in the Panama Canal, where a North Korean freighter was intercepted containing ancient Soviet-era weaponry from Cuba, hidden under tons of brown sugar. Roberto Sura, who heads up the Cuba program at the USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, joins us to discuss this flashback to the Cold War and whether it could set back fledgling efforts at improving US-Cuban relations. Then we'll get an analysis of how the reversal of political Islam in Egypt is reverberating throughout the Middle East and the behind-the-scenes struggle between Saudi Arabia and Qatar to shape the future of political Islam to prevent democratic reform infecting their own repressive feudal monarchies. Veteran New York Times Middle East correspondent Yusuf Ibrahim joins us to discuss the widespread disappointment and cynicism towards radical Islamic regimes like Hezbollah and Hamas amongst Arabs, as well as the rejection of theocratic intrusion into secular life in Turkey, Tunisia, and Egypt. Then finally, as the hunger strike in California's prisons over solitary confinement enters its 10th day, we will speak with Sarah Shurd, who has an article at the ACLU's website, "The Iranian Government Locked Me in Solitary Confinement for 410 Days. Today my thoughts are with the hunger strikers." We will discuss her ordeal as a political hostage in Iran and an article in Wednesday's New York Times by Wilbert Rideau, who spent 12 years in solitary confinement. Joining us is Roberto Sura, who's a professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. He's a veteran print journalist with extensive experience in foreign, domestic, and Washington coverage as a senior staff writer for The New York Times and The Washington Post. Prior to joining the Annenberg School, he served as the director of the Pew Hispanic Center, a research organization in Washington, D.C., which he founded in 2001. He heads up the Cuba program at USC's Annenberg School and was recently in Cuba. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roberto.
Good to be with you.
And this recent discovery of Cuban weapons aboard a North Korean ship in the Panama Canal has clearly taken a lot of people by surprise and has led to questions about hidden ties between these two countries, both communist countries, both locked in a kind of time warp. You were in Cuba recently. My understanding is that there's a kind of an attempt at a kind of rapprochement underway between the United States and Cuba, and I'm wondering whether, one, that is for real, and two, how much this incident in the Panama Canal is going to affect that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would go as far as to say that there's an active effort at a rapprochement. I mean, it's been a relatively quiet time in terms of sort of new hostilities or some big unresolved issues. There hasn't been a lot of movement. The Obama administration has eased travel restrictions for Americans going to Cuba and eased restrictions on remittance sending by Cuban Americans to their families in Cuba. There has not been a big response from the Cubans. There's ongoing talks at sort of a functional level, but there's neither side has made a big move. What's surprising about this very, very bizarre incident is that the Cubans were doing something that they had to know would provoke a very negative reaction, not just by the U.S., but by all kinds of other people they care about, if it was discovered. And it's just, so it's hard to know what they were trying to accomplish here and how they calculated that it would be worth the costs that they are now going to pay for being involved in a clandestine arms shipment through the Panama Canal.
Because they are, Cuba is a UN member state, and Cuba is therefore breaking the UN sanctions on.
Yeah, there's that, and you know, North Korea doesn't win you a lot of brownie points anywhere. They've managed to create a problem with Panama, you know, a fellow Latin American country along the way, and they've ended up in a very kind of public way associating themselves with a pariah country. Now, Cuba and North Korea have relations. A senior North Korean military official was just in Havana a few weeks ago. Cubans have, you know, maintained relations with Iran and all kinds of people, but visits and sort of polite cordiality is one thing. Trafficking in weapons, even ops, you know, is something else, bound to provoke a negative reaction. What's peculiar about it, this is, you're talking about really obsolete, kind of useless stuff. So I don't think we really know yet, I mean, what the actual transaction that was taking place between the 10,000 tons of sugar and the 240 tons of airplane and missile and radar equipment that was on that boat.
Underneath the brown sugar, right?
Underneath the brown sugar. It's
right.
Very strange.
And that was basically two anti-aircraft missile batteries, nine disassembled rockets, two MiG-21 fighter jets, and 15 MiG-21 engines, all, you know, from the Soviet era, basically going back to the 1950s and 1960s. But isn't Cuba in many ways, and so is North Korea, a kind of time warp in when you go there? And I mean, one of the things that somebody that I was talking to recently who was in North Korea was saying that what's completely surreal in North Korea is that there's only one shade of lipstick and all the women wear it.
Yeah, I mean, they are both, I mean, they're among the two most isolated countries in the world, but they're at very different scales, in part because Cuba's a, you know, 45-minute plane ride from Miami, and it was much more integrated. It's in a time warp in terms of not much has been built in recent years, but you can watch contemporary television from the United States and Europe, and people have seen, get DVDs of movies, and there's lots of lipstick and hair coloring that's coming in, being brought by visitors from Miami and elsewhere. So it's at a very different level of isolation than North Korea. So, you know, in terms of the military value of this stuff for either country is very hard to figure. You know, the North Koreans, you know, have got much more advanced military than this. Even, you know, the Cubans, you know, although they have had no money to spend on their military, particularly for the last 20-odd years since the fall of the Soviet Union, it's this stuff predates that. So it's very hard to understand. The other thing to keep in mind is the Cubans are broke. They're trying very hard in a lot of different ways to figure out how to generate hard currency. I mean, I wonder, you know, could they possibly be selling this stuff? Are the North Koreans selling this stuff? I don't know.
Well, when you mentioned, though, Roberto Suro, again, professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, a veteran print journalist with extensive experience in foreign, domestic, and Washington coverage as a senior staff writer for The New York Times and The Washington Post. And prior to joining Annenberg, he served as director of the Pew Hispanic Center, a research organization in Washington, D.C., which he founded in 2001. He now heads up the Cuba program at USC's Annenberg School and was recently in Cuba. You mentioned that the dollars are in use in Cuba and people have access to international news and CNN International. Of course, that would only be those few Cubans who are beneficiaries of the dollar economy, right? There's two.
Yeah, you can buy pirated DVDs of TV shows and movies on the street. Mm-hmm. They're not expensive and they're not hard to get. So it's the degree of just of cultural isolation can be, it's easy to exaggerate in Cuba's case.
Right.
They're not living, you know, on the far side of the moon.
No, well, doesn't that lead to the conclusion that the embargo is entirely absurd, that through the cracks you've created this connection, largely through Cuban families coming back and forth, and the more of that goes on, the better for all. I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's a whole other question, is whether the U.S. is, the objective of the embargo was to produce a change in regime, and, you know, one Castro brother or another has been running the country for almost 54 years, so it's not, one thing we know for sure about the embargo is it has not accomplished its primary objective. Whether, you know, there's a much more complicated question of whether economic improvement in Cuba now promotes change towards a market economy or not. I mean, do you want to create suffering there to serve some kind of national purpose in the U.S. or not? It's one of the factors that makes this ship all the more bizarre, which is that Cuba's in the midst, even, you know, as we speak, this summer, in taking fairly substantial steps, advancing the economic reforms that are, you know, slowly and in small steps moving towards a market economy, increasing the number of cooperatives, deregulating state companies, opening other areas of the economy to private enterprise, all the stuff that Raul Castro has been talking about since he became president several years ago have been proceeding and getting some traction. Why in the midst of this they would choose to get involved in an adventure with 50-year-old military equipment and a North Korean freighter is really hard to figure, because they're spending a lot of time and effort moving in another direction. And this seems very contradictory. So,
well, you were saying earlier, Roberto Cirro, that the country's broke. And my understanding is that if it was not for Venezuela's largesse supplying oil and in turn paying for Cuban doctors, et cetera, that are working in Venezuela, the country would be in dire straits.
No, there's no question. I think it's Venezuela one way or another provides a subsidy that, you know, there are different ways of estimating it, but it's your $4, $5, $6, $7 billion, depending on how you add it up. What aside from the number, what's important is that that is the money that allows Cuba to buy food and fuel on the hard currency market to keep the country functioning. Without that subsidy, Cuba would be in an unsustainable economic condition.
Well, do you think, just in closing, that there will be some punishment from the United States? I mean, you know, the United States, as we just mentioned, I mentioned the counterintuitive nature of the embargo that's gone on for, what, 7 decades now, that has had the opposite results in terms of regime change. But we still have an anti-Castro kind of lobby over here. So is this another opportunity? I'm not sure what more they can do to punish.
Well, sure. I mean, for one thing we know for sure about this episode is that it already has given fuel to people who argue against the legitimacy of this, the Castro government, the Raul Castro government, and who insist on that it's a good thing to maintain the embargo, that the United States should not let up the pressure on Cuba. And the Cuban government, the Cuban people are very aware, they're hyper aware of the fact that domestic U.S. politics and a fairly small part of the political spectrum that cares about Cuba policy, you know, it is a minority of people among Cuban Americans in Florida in particular who care about U.S. policy towards Cuba. Otherwise, nobody really much cares about it. It's just not on the radar screen. But that this gives fuel to people who say, you know, don't ease up, don't cut them any slack. And they have to have known that. And you know, one possible explanation for this action and other things Cuba has done over the years is that there are some elements of the Cuban government who believe that keeping the embargo in place is a good thing, mm-hmm. that not being exposed to the U.S. economy is a good thing, and that maintaining a hostile relationship with the U.S. is one of a raison d'etre for the regime. And for a very nationalistic approach to maintaining political controls is the idea that this is a little country that faces hostility from a giant neighbor. That has been a steady theme from the start of the revolution, and perhaps certainly, you know, a long-standing argument that Cuba has provoked the U.S. in the past, because there is a certain amount of self-interest in maintaining a circumstance of hostility.
Well, Roberto Sura, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Roberto Sura, who is a professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. He's a veteran print journalist with extensive experience in foreign, domestic, and Washington coverage as a senior staff writer for The New York Times and The Washington Post. And prior to joining the Annenberg School, he served as director of the Pew Hispanic Center, a research organization in Washington, D.C., which he founded in 2001. He now heads up the Cuba program at the USC's Annenberg School and was recently in Cuba. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the reversal of political Islam in the Middle East.